Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loke, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. On April 22nd at 3 p.m. in the State Farm Lecture Hall of MTSU's Business and Aerospace Building, the Department of Geosciences will sponsor an Earth Day lecture/celebration. Usually it's a lecture on an environmental topic when we talk about going green here on the campus, but this time the lecture will be given by Ron Zorowski, who is the director of the Tennessee Division of Geology and the state geologist. He's going to be talking about the New Madrid seismic zone and the great 1811-1812 earthquakes that occurred there. This is the 200th anniversary of those quakes coming up. And these are the quakes that created Real Foot Lake. This is particularly timely in light of recent earthquakes in Haiti, Chile, Sumatra, and of course Japan, where a 9.0 quake rocked the northeast section of that country, literally to the very marrow of its bone, as well as the resulting tsunami and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant crisis, which is ongoing and has been raised to the international level of 7, which is a Chernobyl-sized nuclear crisis. Ron Zorowski joins us now on the telephone from a conference in Memphis, Tennessee.
It's the Seismological Society of America. This is their 2011 annual meeting.
And they couldn't have picked a more appropriate place to hold it, right there in Memphis, right along the New Madrid Fault, right?
Yes, we're very, very close to the New Madrid seismic zone. There's actually a fault that's been identified fairly recently that runs fairly close to Memphis, just to the west of Memphis, called the Meeman-Shelby Fault, that up until maybe a couple of years ago wasn't even known about, that, you know, that particular fault. So.
And it is pronounced New Madrid after the town in the state of Missouri, New Madrid, Missouri.
New Madrid, Missouri, that's correct.
Right, not New Madrid, as some people want to call it in the national media.
Right, it just depends. You know, people have different pronunciations, but typically it's after the, you know, named after the little town of New Madrid, Missouri, which is kind of at the epicenter of the three major earthquakes that occurred in 1811 and 1812.
Every once in a while, we will receive a bulletin over the Associated Press saying that an earthquake was registered in the state of Tennessee somewhere and somebody's dishes rattled in a small town. But this state, at least in my lifetime, has not really felt an earthquake of humongous proportions. So how close to a catastrophic level earthquake are we in the state of Tennessee? How vulnerable are we to it?
Well, that's up to quite a bit of debate. There's a lot of discussion on recurrence rates. Typically, from the information we've gathered, basically since about 1970, we know there have been a series of earthquakes large enough to produce what we call liquefaction features, things like sand blows that require a fairly significant amount of ground motion to occur. We can look at some of the material in these sand blows. They're basically what they are is they look like little sand volcanoes or sand geysers when they're actually occurring. They typically occur along river floodplains where we have a lot of unconsolidated material, particularly saturated soil and then sand below the surface. When these things erupt to the surface, they're typically in areas where a lot of Native Americans used to locate, along rivers where there was water. They could use the mussels for food, they could fish and things like that. Floodplain material tends to be pretty mucky, not very pleasant stuff. And so when these sand blows occurred, it looks like pure white beach sand in most places. And what they would do is, if they were large enough, some of them may have been several hundred feet across at the surface, some of them smaller than that. But they would typically, if they had a choice, would build their structures, their living structures on these things, and then also build their building fire, their cooking fires and things like that in this nice pure white sand. And so what we've got is we have remains of things like charcoal that can be dated using carbon-14 methods very, very accurately. And depending on where those sand blows are, it gives us an idea of when an earthquake occurred, you know, within just, you know, a few tens of years or so. And so we see a number of these things buried in the subsurface, stacked on top of one another. And by dating these things, we go back about, I think it's about 5,000 years, actually. There's a number of major earthquakes that have left that evidence behind. And we know typically the recurrence interval is about every 500 years for very, very significant events. That gives us a probability of about 10% in 81 years that we'll have a magnitude 6 to 7, something like that, that could produce a lot of damage. And so what we're looking at, the primary evidence we have that we need to be concerned still today, is that these things keep reoccurring. And it seems like when they don't occur just one at a time, but in clusters. 1811 to 1812, there were three main shocks and one aftershock kind of between the second and third main shocks. And when we look in the geologic record, we see some of these sand blows that seem to be piled one on top of another with no soil zones in between, so we know that there was a relatively short period of time between when these sand blows actually occurred. So what we're looking at, when we look at just the physical geological evidence, we see a recurrence interval. We have no reason to assume that the seismic activity has ceased. Now, we also look at other different things. Some researchers, which would typically like to write in the more popular magazines like Science and things like that, are looking at motions at the Earth's surface based on global positioning instruments. And what they're finding, although there's not a very, very tight density, there's enough of these instruments in and around the West Tennessee area, the New Madrid seismic zone area. And what they're seeing over the past 10 to 11 years or so is very, very little movement at the surface. In most cases, 2 millimeters per year or less, almost not even enough to detect. Some of them are assuming, based on that lack of motion, that basically the imagined seismic zone is dying, there's no more motion occurring that we can detect, and they tend to look at the risk estimates and say that we know the hazard is there, which is the earthquake risk, is basically when you apply that hazard to built areas, to populated areas. And some of the U.S. Geological Survey estimates, folks that are looking at strictly at GPS measurements, think that the estimates, the risk estimates, are too high.
With which body of research do you concur?
We're looking at really a lot of different things. Now, some of the researchers that are looking at the GPS estimates saying, okay, we're looking typically in California, you can actually measure faults at the surface. You put an instrument on one side of the fault, you put it on the other side of the fault. There's really only one surface fault that we can see in the imagined seismic zone, which is the Realfoot Fault. It caused Realfoot Lake to form. It's actually an uplift. Other researchers are looking at the GPS and saying, okay, we're not seeing a lot of movement at the surface, but the problem is that bedrock through most of the area under the Mississippi River is about 3,000 feet deep. And we question whether or not you're actually going to see any motion that might be occurring along those fault zones 3,000 feet up at the surface. So some of the GPS folks, they are questioning the data they're seeing. There's also a question as to whether or not the movement might be distributed across the entire Mississippi embayment, where you're not going to see very much at individual stations, yet it could be building up across that whole region. We're also looking at some of the strain that we can measure through the air, and it looks to be like there is some strain. So we're looking at a lot of different evidence, but the current thinking is that we really have nothing definitive to tell us that activity in this area has ceased.
So you can't really take, say, you talked about the intervals, you can't really take the sand blows, for example. Well, you could take them as red flags of activity. You can't really surmise how far down the line the next major earthquake will occur. You can't pinpoint the year on the basis of past performance.
That's right. What we're looking at basically is a probability. It's just like when you predict whether it's going to rain today or not. At any one time, there's a 10% chance that we could experience a significant seismic event. Now, this is a New Madrid-type seismic event. When you look at a magnitude 6 or something like that, which is more likely to occur maybe in a 50-year interval, something like that, you're looking at a 25 to maybe 40% chance. So the chances are greater of a an event that's not quite as strong. The problem with earthquakes in the central United States, unlike in California, they experience a lot of earthquakes fairly frequently of fairly significant magnitude. In the central United States, we're looking at a very low probability, very high impact event. It's not real likely that it's going to happen, but we have to ask ourselves, you know, do we want to play a gambling game? Because when you look at places like Japan, Japan is one of the better prepared countries in the world as far as earthquakes are concerned. They didn't expect a magnitude 9 or, you know, whatever the final magnitude they determined was to occur over there. In Christchurch, New Zealand, there have been a couple of events last September and then one again in February. They're actually along one of the areas that we know earthquakes occur. They can actually see movement at the surface. There's some faults that go through that area. And they got hit with a 7.1 in last fall, and then again with an aftershock, it was like a 6.3 in February, had not the same type of damage or fatalities. I think they had less than 200 fatalities and a couple of buildings that collapsed that they didn't really know how they would react in an earthquake. One problem we have in the central United States is we have a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings. We like to put brick facades on our buildings that are basically not tied to anything as far as the building structure is concerned. We have a lot of limestone or marble facings on the outsides of buildings, and typically where most of the damage occurs and where most of the fatalities occur is from falling debris.
There are parts of the United States that are more savvy about that, like Southern California, right, where they're building out of better or more appropriate materials for a fault zone, right?
That's correct, and they also, what they'll do is their taller buildings, they will isolate them from the foundation where the building can actually move back and forth. Even though the ground is moving under it, the ground can slide back and forth, and the building just sort of sits there because of its momentum and its inertia.
That's what the reporters were talking about when they were talking about buildings swaying in the Japan earthquake. That's exactly what they're supposed to do.
Right. They'll sway, or they'll actually just, you know, rock back and forth without so much swaying, but they won't break at the base.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Japan earthquake because one of our retired economics professors, Dr. Kiyoshi Kawahito, was in his native Japan at the time of the quake. And if you'll forgive this metaphor, he seemed to take a very zen-like attitude toward it. It was not quite hurricane fatigue like people experience in New Orleans, where they just say, oh yeah, sure, we've heard it before, and then they sit there and the big one hits. But more of a, yes, we know we live in an earthquake zone, we know what to do, we're ready, a sort of calmness based on level of preparation, despite the fact that this one really knocked them off their pins because it was a Lulu. So how would you compare the level of earthquake awareness and preparedness in the United States versus that of Japan?
We're getting a whole lot better. There's an organization called the Central United States Earthquake Consortium. It's been in existence, I guess, now for about 20 years. All of the surrounding states to the New Madrid Seismic Zone are members of that association. There's also a group of an association of CUSEC state geologists, and we're working together to communicate with one another, to share resources, information, and things like that. We're also working with our emergency managers to educate people on what they can do. We're trying to look at infrastructure to figure out how we can harden some of our facilities and things like that. We're looking at communications issues. We basically assume that all communication is going to be down. And so what we'll be relying on is a very old system that's been in place. The amateur radio operators have an extensive worldwide network. And there is software and there's hardware now where we can actually tie into that network and send emails over the amateur radio system. And so that's basically our fallback communications. If everything else is down, if the satellite systems are down, cell phones are down, there's no electricity, basically all the amateur radio operators are, they're pretty self-sufficient. They have generators so that they'll stay on the air no matter what's going on. And so as far as communications are concerned, we're doing a lot for that.
So we will notice a revival of the CB craze of the 1970s in this country.
Kind of, yeah. And in fact, the Tennessee Emergency Management operations center has its own amateur radio station that sits right next to the main operations center there. And one of the big issues that we're dealing with is when we talk particularly about earthquake risk, is that in the central U.S., there's a new international building code came out a number of years ago that does have some seismic safety standards. When that came out, they were recommending that the risk in the central U.S. was at least as high as in California. And that's hard for people to accept because we don't have very frequent earthquakes. Most people haven't experienced the motion and the shock of the earthquakes. And when you talk about hardening your infrastructure and buildings against earthquakes, it's a fairly expensive proposition to retrofit buildings and structures. It costs a lot of money. Even when you're building new structures, it can add maybe as much as 10%, maybe even more to that of the cost of actually building those buildings. And right now, economically, the country's going through quite a bit of difficulty. And so when you talk about spending even more money than people are going to spend to begin with, to try to save lives and save structures, it's a really hard sell, and it's hard to get people to realize that.
That raises the question of whether we have the political will to get this done.
In some of the more vulnerable cities, I think we do. The mayor of Memphis is certainly on board with the efforts that are going on. Memphis Light, Gas, and Water is doing a lot to try to keep their systems up and running. And one of the things we can do is when we look at earthquakes around the world, it'll give us a pretty good idea of what happens when you do not build your structures, your earth-resistant structures. You can have an earthquake like the one they had in Haiti with literally hundreds of thousands of deaths that is not nearly as severe as an earthquake in other places. Now, in Japan, what happened, their situation is a little bit different from ours. The earthquakes are not really what did the major damage. Even the nuclear power plants withstood the shock of the earthquakes. Those basic containment structures stayed intact. They did not fail.
It was the tsunami.
It was the tsunami, and they hadn't really thought very much ahead about that because all of their the tanks, their diesel storage tanks for their backup generators, of course, the whole power grid went down when the tsunami came across. It knocked basically everything down. And so they had no power, they had no backup power, their generators, there was no fuel to fuel the generators to cool basically the reactor core. And then also they have a lot of material, spent nuclear material that was stored in water. And when they lost the ability to start cooling those fuel rods and things like that, that's really what caused, well, in part, some of the explosions they had because they started generating some hydrogen gas, which ignited and it blew the roof off some of the outer containment structures. And so their real crisis the one that's continuing with their nuclear plants is one where they just didn't have their backup power generation secured. Now what TVA has done, TVA has gone back because their structures, nuclear power plants, are built to withstand a certain level of earthquake. The TVA is, most of their power plants are located in what we call the East Tennessee Seismic Zone, which is not nearly as active as the West Tennessee Seismic Zone, but USGS estimates that we could have a magnitude 7.5 based on the geology of the area in the East Tennessee Seismic Zone.
And with Oak Ridge in East Tennessee, that raises some frightening possibilities.
Right, and it's not Oak Ridge so much, but the nuclear power plants. One of the slides I'll be showing during my talk is why do we need concern about, seismic hazard in East Tennessee, and it's an aerial view of one of the nuclear power plants sitting next to a dam which has a reservoir behind it. Now, one of the things that TVA has done is they've gone back and they've looked at all their plans and preparedness, and they say, okay, we plan for earthquakes. We've also planned for floods. One thing they didn't think about was what if we have a dam failure and an earthquake, possibly combined with a tornado coming through the area. So they said, what if we get hit with all the potential hazards that could affect us at one time? Can we handle that? And one of the things that TVA has done, some of their reactors are identical to the reactors over in Japan as far as the construction and things like that. But what TVA has done is say, okay, we're going to assume not a tsunami because you don't have tsunamis on lakes. It's an ocean type of event. But they said, okay, what if we get flooded? or if one of the dams upstream, there's one in Kentucky, there was some concern, Wolf Creek Dam a couple of years ago, that it might fail because of some leakage. Okay, what if we get a failure at the Wolf Creek Dam? That water comes down, it hits the next reservoir between us and comes all the way down. Can our site withstand a flood? And so what they've done is all of TVA's backup generators are behind. They're either other ground in waterproof bunkers or they're behind very, very heavy waterproof doors. In addition, all of their fuel tanks are secured as well, so that even if a flood washes over the entire nuclear power plant, as long as those concrete and steel structures are still standing, they're going to be able to keep the coolant, the water that cools the reactors, and also the spent fuel that's stored on site. They'll be able to keep them cool. And so we know the reactor cores are probably going to survive because everywhere around the world, nuclear reactors have been exposed to even very strong seismic activity. They've survived. They haven't been compromised. And again, TVA now is making sure that, and what they've done is even throughout the building themselves, they have portable generators and batteries scattered all over the place. They're little yellow carts. They're very well marked. They can move those around to wherever they need. If the diesel generators for some reason are down, they have to get them started back up. They've got all these backup batteries and things like that to keep the pumps going. And so,
are you reassured that this is sufficient? Because I can hear a lot of lay people asking, if TVA wasn't prepared for an ash spill at one of its coal-fired plants, how can we trust that they will be adequately prepared in the event of an earthquake that might cause a nuclear crisis?
TVA has been serious about earthquake hazards for a long, long time. So they have been, in fact, when nuclear power plants are designed, unfortunately, there's most of the places around the country where you've got high population density, they need electricity. And there are not a lot of seismically very, very quiet areas around the country. So we have a lot of nuclear power plants that are in areas that are seismically vulnerable, not maybe to a catastrophic earthquake, but a 5 or 6 magnitude earthquake can do quite a bit of damage. And so they've taken this seriously. Again, one of the things that they've done recently is they've looked at not just one hazard by itself, but a combination of, what's the worst possible thing that could happen, not just from one potential hazard, but from anything we can possibly think of. And TVA, I think another 2 or 3 times a year, they will actually go through exercises to test their systems, to test their evacuation plans. What are they going to do locally if something gets out of hand? How are they going to deal with that? And so they test their communication systems. They test their ability to communicate with the state, because everything, all emergency response is at the local level. And so if we have a nuclear incident, it's going to happen locally. Well, those locals have to be able to communicate with the state. What we do is we determine what the needs are for personnel and resources outside of the state, if necessary, from other regions within the state. And once it goes to that level, then it goes fairly, it usually takes a few days, but then the federal government gets involved because they have a lot of monetary and material resources that even the states don't have, and they can come in then and come behind us and provide resources that we can't even provide at the state level. So we're looking at different scenarios. Usually when they do a workshop, they'll test maybe communication systems, possibly the siren system that exists over there that warns people if there's an event. It basically tells them to either get onto their local news media, the radio or the television, where they will get additional information about what's going on if they need to be concerned about either evacuation, sheltering in place, whatever it might be. And so,
Ron, what assurance, as somebody who works in government, you know that bureaucracies, different aspects of the bureaucracy don't always talk to each other, and some agencies can be very TERF-centric because they think that constitutes job security, and they don't always share information back and forth. This was one of the findings of the 9/11 Commission. Of course, that was a man-made disaster, not a natural one, but they decided or determined that federal agencies simply were not sharing information that could have been helpful. So, how can the public be reassured that all aspects of the bureaucracy here in Tennessee are on the same page of the same playbook at the same time with regard to earthquake preparedness?
one of the keys to that is the model that, that Tennessee's using. We've sort of, I guess, really invented it, is that there are about 70 of what we call emergency service coordinators. We are people, we represent different departments within the state. There are also all of the military is represented. The communications industry is represented. Walmart has a representative in the pit. The fire departments are represented. The hospitals are represented. All the different voluntary organizations that take part. Basically, anybody who is going to be involved in the response effort. Each individual group actually has a representative sitting together in what we call the pit. And we talk to one another all the time. We do workshops. We do what we call tabletop exercises. We've had a number of workshops where state and local emergency responders have gotten together, talked about what are the local needs, what kind of communications issues do you have, how can we better communicate, make sure we've got, we all have systems that where we can communicate with one another. One of the problems, you know, in New York was that each agency had its own frequency, you know, nobody was talking to one another. And so as emergency service coordinators, we're all basically empowered to act on behalf of our individual agencies. And so we talk ahead of time, we plan ahead of time, we go through workshops, we go through different exercises, and what we'll usually do is we'll test different aspects. This national level exercise is going to really test communications and coordination between local, state, and federal agencies. Typically, the federal agencies will kind of do their own thing, and the state agencies, we work a lot with state and local, but this exercise is going to basically be testing how well we can communicate with one another. And by constantly exercising and going through training, we know people face-to-face are going to be dealing with during a time of crisis. Now, we go through all these plans and everything, but what they what typically say is that, you know, the best-laid plans of mice and men, you know, they go arrive very quickly. But it's not the plans themselves that's so important. It's the planning process, the fact that we've gotten together and talked about what if we have an earthquake in the middle of wintertime, combined with an ice storm, how are we going to deal with all the different the devastation and destruction that things are going to have? We look at basically a worst-case scenario.
As in the case of Japan, it's not just the earthquake in and of itself. It's what is caused by the earthquake that puts crisis on top of crisis that you have to be considerate of.
Right. It's what we call cascading effects. Typically in an earthquake, one of the main cascading effects is fires. Because when you start shaking the ground a lot, you break your natural gas lines, you break your water lines. And in the central United States, a big issue, we really don't know how it's going to react, is the power grid. There's only three power grids in the United States. It's one in the east, one in the west, and then Texas has its own. And when you start knocking down a lot of the power poles and things like that in West Tennessee, you're looking at a fairly significant, all of a sudden, impact on the entire power grid. And as all of a sudden you've got towers going down, you're going to start sending, you've got electricity that's ordinarily being distributed, and all of a sudden you're starting to send more electricity to areas where all of a sudden there's no demand for it. And we're not sure how the whole system is going to react, but there, you know, potentially could be millions of people without power for an extended period of time in the entire United States, not just in the New Madrid seismic zone area. Also, we've got all of your major natural gas and petroleum product pipelines going up to Chicago in the Northeast run about 20 miles west of Memphis. And so Chicago and New York may be freezing in the dark because of what happens along the New Madrid seismic zone. So we look at it as being prepared for basically any of the different hazards that you might be affected by. So, you know, preparing for an earthquake, even this as far away as Nashville, it's going to be, you'll be ready for all these other things that are much more common, more frequent, but they can still put you, you know, in a bad situation if you can't get gas for your car, if you have no electricity, things like that.
Ron Zarowski, director of the Tennessee Division of Geology and the State Geologist, you've given us a lot to chew on, but if you want to learn more, go to the MTSU Department of Geosciences Earth Day celebration at 3 p.m. in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building to hear Mr. Zarowski's talk, and following that, there will be an Earth Day cookout at the MTSU Geology Museum. Mr. Zarowski, on the telephone from Memphis. Thanks for being with us today, Ron, on MTSU On the Record. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.